Flight into Disaster, Earl Stanley Gardner. Only once before had the woman in the club car ever known panic, not merely fear, but the real panic which paralyzes the senses. That had been in the mountains when she had tried to take a shortcut to camp. When she realized she was lost, there was a sudden overpowering desire to run. What was left of her sanity warned her, but panic made her feel that only by flight could she escape the menace of the unknown. The silent mountains, the somber woods, had suddenly become enemies, leering in hostility. Only by running did she feel she could escape. By running, the very worst thing she could have done. Now, surrounded by the luxury of a crack transcontinental train, she again experienced that same panic. Once more there was that overpowering desire to run. Someone had searched her compartment while she had been at dinner. She knew it was a man. He had tried to leave things just as he had found them, but there were little things that a woman would have noticed that the man didn't even see. Her plaid coat, which had been hung in the little steel closet so that the back was to the door, had been turned so the buttons were toward the door. A little thing, but a significant thing which had been the first to catch her attention, leaving her for the moment cold and numb. Now, seated in the club car, she strove to maintain an attitude of outward calm by critically inspecting her hands. Actually, she was taking stock of the men who were in the car. Her problem was complicated by the fact that she was a compactly formed young woman, with smooth lines, clear eyes, a complete quota of curves, and under ordinary circumstances, a latent smile always quivering at the corners of her mouth. It was, therefore, only natural that every male animal in the club car sat up and took notice. The fat man across the aisle who held a magazine in his pudgy hands was not reading. He sat like a Buddha, motionless, his half-closed, lazy-lidded eyes fixed upon some imaginary horizon far beyond the confines of the car. Yet she felt those eyes were taking a surreptitious interest in everything she did. There was something sinister about him, from the big diamond on the middle finger of his right hand to the rather ornate $25 cravat which begged for attention above the bulging expanse of his vest. Then there was the man in the chair on her right. He hadn't spoken to her, but she knew that he was going to, waiting only for an opportunity to make his remark sound like the casual comment of a fellow passenger. He was in his late 20s, bronzed by exposure, steely blue of eye. His mouth held the firmness of a man who has learned to command first himself and then others. The train lurched. The man's hand reached for the glass on the little stand between them. He glanced apprehensively at her skirt.
"Sorry," he said.
"It didn't spill,"
she replied almost automatically.
"I'll lower the danger point," he said, raising the glass to his lips. "Going all the way through? I'm getting off at 6 o'clock in a cold Wyoming morning."
For a moment her panic-numbed brain failed to appreciate the full significance of his remark. Then she experienced a sudden surge of relief. Here, then, was one man whom she could trust. She knew that the man who had searched her baggage hadn't found what he wanted, because she had had it with her, neatly folded, fastened to the bottom of her left foot by strong adhesive tape. Therefore, the enemy would stay on the train as long as she was on it, waiting, watching, growing more and more desperate until at last, perhaps in the dead of night, he would. She knew only too well that he would stop at nothing. One murder had already been committed. But now she had found one person whom she could trust, a man who had no interest in the thing she was hiding, a man who might well be a possible protector. He seemed mildly surprised at her sudden friendliness.
"I didn't know this train stopped anywhere at that ungodly hour,"
she ventured, smiling.
"A flag stop," he explained.
Across the aisle, the fat man had not moved a muscle. Yet she felt absolutely certain that those glittering eyes were concentrating on her and that he was listening as well as watching.
"You live in Wyoming?"
she asked.
"I did as a boy. Now I'm going back. I lived and worked on my uncle's cattle ranch. He died and left it to me. At first I thought I'd sell it. It would bring a small fortune. but now I'm tired of the big cities. I'm going back to live on the ranch.
Won't it be frightfully lonely?
At times. She wanted to cling to him now, dreading the time when she would have to go back to her compartment. She felt the trainmen must have a master key which could open even a bolted door in the event of sickness or if a passenger rang for help. There must be a master key which would manipulate even a bolted door. And if trainmen had such a key, the man who had searched her compartment would have one. Frank Hardwick, before he died, had warned her. "Remember," he had said, "they're everywhere. They're watching when you don't know you're being watched. When you think you're running away and into safety, you'll simply be rushing into a carefully laid trap." She hoped there was no trace of the inner tension within her as she smiled at the man on her right.
"Do tell me about the cattle business," she said.
All night she had crouched in her compartment, watching the door, waiting for that first flicker of telltale motion which would show the doorknob was being turned. Then she would scream, pound on the walls of the compartment, make sufficient commotion to spread an alarm. Nothing had happened. Probably that was the way they had planned it. They'd let her spend one sleepless night. Then, when fatigue had numbed her senses, the train abruptly slowed. She glanced at her wristwatch, saw that it was 5:55, and knew the train was stopping for the man who had inherited the cattle ranch. Howard Kane was the name he had given her after she had encouraged him to tell her all about himself. Howard Kane, 28, unmarried, presumably wealthy, his mind scarred by battle experiences, seeking the healing quality of the big, silent places, the one man on the train whom she knew she could trust. There was a quiet competency about him, one felt he could handle any situation, and now he was getting off the train. Suddenly a thought gripped her. They would hardly be expecting her to take the initiative. They always kept the initiative. That was why they always seemed so damnably efficient, so utterly invincible. They chose the time, the place, and the manner. Give them that advantage, and there wasn't time to reason the thing out. She jerked open the door of the little closet, whipped out her plaid coat, turned the fur collar up around her neck, and as the train eased to a creaking stop, opened the door of her compartment and thrust out a cautious head. The corridor was deserted. She could hear the vestibule door being opened at the far end of the Pullman. She ran to the opposite end of the car, fumbled for a moment with the fastenings of the vestibule door on the side next to the double track, then got it open and raised the platform. Cold morning air, tanged with high elevation, rushed in to meet her, dispelling the train atmosphere, stealing the warmth from her garments. The train started to move. She scrambled down the stairs, jumped for the graveled roadbed by the side of the track. The train gathered speed. Dark, silent cars whizzed past her with continuing acceleration until the noise of the wheels became a mere hum. The steel rails readjusted themselves to the cold morning air, giving cracking sounds of protest. Overhead, stars blazed in steady brilliance. To the east was the first trace of daylight. She looked for a town. There was none. She could make out the faint outlines of a loading corral and cattle chute. Somewhere behind her was a road. An automobile was standing on this road, the motor running. Headlight sent twin cones of illumination knifing the darkness, etching into brilliance the stunted sagebrush shivering nervously under the impact of a cold north wind. Two men were talking. A door slammed. She started running frantically.
"Wait!" she called out. "Wait for me!"
Back on the train, the fat man, fully dressed and shaved, contemplated the open vestibule door, then padded back to the recently vacated compartment and walked in. He didn't even bother to search the baggage that had been left behind. Instead, he sat down in the chair, held a telegraph blank against a magazine, and wrote out his message. The bungling search did the job. She's left the train. It only remains to close the trap. I'll get off at the first place where I can rent a plane and contact the sheriff. 10 minutes later, the fat man found the porter.
"I find the elevation bothering me,"
he said.
I'm going to have to leave the train. Get the conductor.
You won't get no lower by getting off, the porter said.
No, but I'll get bracing fresh air and a doctor who'll give me a heart stimulant. I've been this way before. Get the conductor.
This time the porter saw the $20 bill in the fat man's fingers. Seated between the two men in the warm interior of the car, she sought to concoct a convincing story. Howard Kane said by way of introduction,
This is Buck Doxey. I'm afraid I didn't catch your name last night.
Nell Lindsay, she said quickly.
Buck Doxey, granite-faced, kept one hand on the steering wheel while he doffed a 5-gallon hat.
Pleased to meet you, ma'am.
She sensed his cold hostility, his tight-lipped disapproval. Howard Kane gently prodded for an explanation.
It was a simple case of cause and effect, she said, laughing nervously. It was so stuffy in the car I didn't sleep at all. So,
she went on quickly,
I decided that I'd get out for a breath of fresh air. When the train slowed and I looked at my wristwatch, I knew it was your stop and, well, I expected the train would be there for at least a few minutes. I couldn't get a porter to get the vestibule open, so I did it myself and jumped down to the ground. That was where I made my mistake.
Go on, he said.
At a station, you step down to a platform that's level with the tracks, but here I'd jumped onto a slanting shoulder of gravel and sprawled flat. When I got up, the step of the car was so far above me, well, you have to wear skirts to understand what I mean.
Kane nodded gravely. Buck turned his head and gave Kane a quartering glance. She said,
I guess I could have made it at that if I'd had sense enough to pull my skirt all the way up to the hips, but I couldn't make it on that first try, and there wasn't time for a second one. The train started to move. Good heavens, they must have just thrown you off.
I'm traveling light, Kane said.
Well,
she told him,
that's the story. Now, just what do I do?
Why, you accept our hospitality, of course.
I couldn't wait here for the next train?
Nothing stops here except to discharge passengers coming from a division point, he said.
But there's a station there. Isn't there someone on duty?
Only when the cattle are being shipped, Buck Doxey explained. This is a loading point.
Oh.
She settled back against the seat and was conscious of a reassuring masculine friendship on her right side, a cold detachment on her left side.
I suppose it's horribly ravenous of me, but do we get to the ranch before breakfast?
I'm afraid not, Kane said. It's slow going. Only 60 feet of the road is paved.
60 feet?
That's right. We cross the main transcontinental highway about 5 miles north of here.
What do we do about breakfast?
Well, Kane said, in the trunk of the car there's a coffee pot and a canteen of water. I'm quite certain Buck brought along a few eggs and some ham.
You mean stop right out here in the open and cook?
When you stop here, you're in the open, ma'am, Buck said, and somehow made it seem his words were in answer to some unjustified criticism. She gave him her best smile.
Would it be impertinent to ask when?
In this next coulee, right here, right now.
The road slanted down to a dry wash that ran east and west. The perpendicular north bank broke the force of the north wind. Buck attested to the lack of traffic on the road by stopping the car squarely in the ruts. They watched the sun rise over the plateau country and ate breakfast. She hoped that Buck Doxey's cold disapproval wouldn't communicate itself to Howard Kane. When Buck produced a battered dishpan, she said,
As the only woman present, I claim the right to the dishes.
Women, Buck said, are...
and abruptly checked himself. She laughingly pushed him aside and rolled up her sleeves.
Where's the soap?
As she was finishing the last dish, she heard the motor of the low-flying plane. All three looked up. The plane, which had been following the badly rutted road, banked into a sharp turn.
Sure giving us the once-over, Buck said, his eyes steady on Kane's face. One of 'em has binoculars, and he's as watchful as a cattle buyer at a loading chute. Don't you think it's about time we find out what we've got into, boss?
I suppose it is, Kane said. Before her startled mind could counter his action, Buck Doxey picked up her purse, which she had left lying on the running board of the car. She flew toward him. Doxey's bronzed steel fingers wrapped around her wet wrist.
Take it easy, ma'am, he said. Take it easy.
He pushed her back, found her driving license.
The real name, he drawled, seems to be Jane Marlowe.
Anything else? Kane asked.
Gobs of money, lipstick, keys, and gosh, what a bankroll.
She went for him blindly.
Doxey said, Now, ma'am, I'm going to have to spank you if you keep on like this.
The plane circled, its occupants obviously interested in the scene on the ground below.
Now, here's something else, Doxey said, taking out a folded newspaper clipping.
She suddenly went limp. There was no use in further pretense. Doxey read aloud.
Following the report of an autopsy surgeon, police who had never been entirely satisfied that the unexplained death of Frank Hardwick was actually a suicide, are searching for his attractive secretary, Jane Marlowe. The young woman reportedly had dinner with Hardwick in a downtown restaurant the night of his death. Hardwick, after leaving Miss Marlowe, according to her story, went directly to the apartment of Eva Ingram, a strikingly beautiful model who has, however, convinced police that she was dining out. Within a matter of minutes after entering the Ingram apartment, Hardwick either jumped or fell from the 8th-story window. With the finding of a witness who says Frank Hardwick was accompanied at least as far as the apartment door by a young woman whose description answers that of Jane Marlowe, and evidence indicating several $1,000 was removed from a concealed floor safe in Hardwick's office, police are anxious once more to question Miss Marlowe. So far, their efforts have definitely not been crowned with success. And here's a picture of this young lady, Buck said, with some more stuff under it. Jane Marlowe, secretary of scientist who jumped from apartment window to his death, is now sought by police after witness claims to have seen her arguing angrily with Frank Hardwick when latter was ringing bell at front door of apartment house from which Hardwick fell or jumped to sidewalk.
Overhead, the plane suddenly ceased its circling and took off in a straight line to the north. As the car proceeded northward, Buck put on speed, deftly avoiding the bad places in the road. Jane Marlowe, who had lapsed into hopeless silence, tried one more last desperate attempt when they crossed the paved road.
"Please," she said, "let me out here. I'll catch a ride back to Los Angeles and report to the police."
Kane's eyes asked a silent question of the driver.
"Nope," Buck said decisively. "That plane was the sheriff's scout plane. He'll expect us to hold you. I don't crave to have no more trouble over women."
"All right," Jane said in a last burst of desperation. "I'll tell you the whole story. Then I'll leave it to your patriotism. I was secretary to Frank Hardwick. He was working on something that had to do with cosmic rays."
"I know," Doxy interrupted sarcastically, "and he dictated his secret formula to you."
"Don't be silly," she said, "but he did know that he was in danger. He told me that if anything happened to him, to take something which he gave to me to a certain individual."
"Just keep on talking," Buck said. "Tell us about the money."
Her eyes were desperate.
"Mr. Hardwick had a concealed safe in the office. He left reserve cash there for emergencies. He gave me the combination, told me that if anything happened to him, I was to go to that safe, take the money and deliver it and a certain paper to a certain scientist in Boston."
Buck's smile of skepticism was certain to influence Kane even more than words.
"Frank Hardwick never jumped out of any window," she went on. "They were waiting for him, and they threw him out."
"Or," Buck said, "a certain young lady became jealous, followed him, got him near an open window, and then gave a sudden, unexpected shove. It has been done, you know.
and people have told the truth," she blazed. "I don't enjoy what I'm doing. I consider it a duty to my country, and I'll probably be murdered just as Frank Hardwick was."
"Now listen," Kane said. "Nice little girls don't jump off trains before daylight in the morning and tell the kind of stories you're telling. You got off that train because you were running away from someone." She turned to Kane.
"I was hoping that you would understand."
"He understands," Buck said, and laughed. After that, she was silent. Overhead, from time to time, the plane came circling back. Once it was gone for nearly 45 minutes, and she dared to hope they had thrown it off the track. But later she realized it had only gone to refuel, and then it was back above them once more. It was nearly 9 when Buck turned off the rutted road and headed toward a group of unpainted, squat log cabins, which seemed to be bracing themselves against the cold wind while waiting for the winter snow. Back of the buildings were timbered mountains. The pilot of the plane had evidently spotted the ranch long ago. Hardly had Buck turned off the road when the plane came circling in for a landing. Jane Marlowe had to lean against the cold wind as she walked from the car to the porch of the cabin. Howard Kane held the door open for her, and she found herself inside a cold room which fairly reeked of masculine tenancy, with a paper-littered desk, guns, deer and elk horns. Within a matter of seconds, she heard the pound of steps on the porch. The door was flung open, and the fat man and a companion stood on the threshold.
"Well, Jane," the fat man said, "you gave us quite a chase, didn't you?"
He turned to the others.
"Reckon I'd better introduce myself, boys."
He reached in his pocket, then took out a wallet and tossed it carelessly on the desk.
"I'm John Findlay of the FBI," he said.
"That's a lie," she said. "Can't you understand? This man is an enemy. Those credentials are forged."
"Well, ma'am," the other newcomer said, stepping forward, "there ain't nothing wrong with my credentials. I'm the sheriff here, and I'm taking you into custody."
He took her purse, said,
"You just might have a gun in here."
He opened the purse. Findlay leaned over to look, said,
"It's all there."
"Come on, Miss Marlowe," the sheriff said. "You're going back in that plane."
"That plane of yours holds 3 people?" Findlay asked.
The sheriff looked appraisingly at the fat man.
"Not us 3.
"I can fly the crate," Findlay said. "I'll take the prisoner in, lock her up, and then fly back for you, and—"
"No, no, no," Jane Marlowe screamed. "Don't you see? Can't you realize this man isn't an officer? I'd never get there. He—"
"Shut up," the sheriff said.
"Sheriff, please, you're being victimized. Call up the FBI and you'll find out that—"
"I've already called up the Los Angeles office of the FBI, the sheriff said.
Kane's brows leveled.
"Was that because you were suspicious, sheriff?"
"Findlay himself suggested it."
Jane was incredulous.
"You mean they told you that—"
"They vouched for him in every way," the sheriff said. "They told me he'd been sent after Jane Marlowe and to give him every assistance. Now I've got to lock you up and—"
"She's my responsibility, sheriff," Findlay said.
The sheriff frowned, then said,
"Okay, I'll fly back and send a deputy out with a car."
"Very well," Findlay agreed. "I'll see that she stays put."
Jane Marlowe said desperately,
"I presume that when Mr. Findlay told you to call the FBI office in Los Angeles, he gave you the number so you wouldn't have to waste time getting it through an operator, didn't he?"
"Why not?"
the sheriff said, smiling good-humoredly.
"He'd be a hell of an FBI man if he didn't know his own telephone number."
The fat man fished a cigar from his pocket, biting off the end and scraping a match into flame. He winked at the sheriff. Howard Kane said to Findlay,
"Mind if I ask a question?"
"Hell no. Go right ahead."
"I'd like to know something of the facts in this case. If you've been working on the case, you'd know."
"Sure thing," Findlay agreed.
getting his cigar burning evenly.
She worked for Hardwick, who was having an affair with a model. We followed him to the model's apartment. They had a quarrel. Hardwick's supposed to have jumped out of the window. She went to his office and took $5,000 out of the safe. The money's in her purse.
So she was jealous?
Jealous and greedy. Don't forget she got $5,000 out of the safe.
I was following my employer's specific instructions in everything I did,
Jane said. Findlay grinned.
What's more,
she blazed,
Frank Hardwick wasn't having any affair with that model. He was lured to her apartment. It was a trap, and he walked right in.
Findlay said,
Yeah, the key we found in his vest pocket fitted the apartment door. He must have found it on the street and was returning it to the owner as an act of gallantry.
The sheriff laughed. Howard Kane glanced speculatively at the very young woman.
She doesn't look like a criminal.
Oh, thank you,
she blazed. Findlay's glance was patronizing.
How many criminals have you seen, buddy?
Doxy rolled a cigarette. His eyes narrowed against the smoke as he squatted down cowboy fashion on the backs of his high-heeled riding boots.
Ain't no question but what she's the one who jimmied the safe, is there?
The money's in her purse, Findlay said.
Any accomplices? Buck asked.
No, it was a combination of jealousy and greed.
Findlay glanced inquiringly at the sheriff.
I'll fly in and send that car out, the sheriff said.
Mind if I fly in with you and ride back with the deputy sheriff? Buck asked eagerly. I'd like to see this country from the air once. There's a paved road other side of that big mountain where the ranger has his station. I'd like to look down on it. Someday they'll connect us up. Now it's an hour's ride by horse.
Sure, the sheriff agreed. Glad to have you.
Just give me time enough to throw a saddle on a horse,
Doxy said.
Kane might want to ride out and look the ranch over. You won't mind, sheriff?
Make it snappy, the sheriff said.
Buck Doxy went to the barn and, after a few minutes, returned leading a dilapidated-looking range pony saddled and bridled. He casually dropped the reins in front of the ranch office and called inside.
Ready any time you are, sheriff.
They started for the airplane. Buck stopped at the car to get a map from the glove compartment, then hurried to join the sheriff. The propeller of the plane gave a half turn, stopped, gave another half turn. The motor sputtered, then roared into action. A moment later, the plane became the focal point of a trailing dust cloud, then raised and swept over the squat log buildings in a climbing turn and headed south. Jane Marlowe and Kane watched it through the window until it became but a speck. Howard Kane said,
Now, Mr. Findlay, I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Sure, go right ahead.
You impressed the sheriff very cleverly, Kane said, but I'd like to have you explain.
Now that it's too late,
Jane Marlowe blazed indignantly.
You've let him.
Kane motioned her to silence.
Don't you see, Miss Marlowe? I had to get rid of the sheriff. He represents the law, right or wrong. But if this man is an imposter, I can protect you against him.
Findlay's hand moved with such rapidity that the big diamond made a streak of glittering light.
Okay, wise guy, he said. Try protecting her against this.
Kane rushed the gun. Sheer surprise slowed Findlay's reaction time. Kane's fist flashed out in a swift arc just before the gun roared. The fat man moved with amazing speed. He rolled with the punch, spun completely around on his heel, and jumped back, the automatic held to his body, his eyes glittering with rage.
Get him up, he said.
The cold animosity of his tone showed that this time there would be no hesitancy. Slowly, Kane's hands came up.
Turn around, Findlay said. Move over by that window. Place your face against the wall. Give me your right hand, Kane. Now the left hand.
A smooth leather thong, which had been deftly knotted into a slipknot, was jerked tight, then knotted into a quick half-hitch. The girl, taking advantage of Findlay's preoccupation, flung herself on him. The bulk of Findlay's big shoulders absorbed the onslaught without making him even shift the position of his feet. He jerked the leather thong into a last knot, turned and struck the girl in the pit of the stomach. She wobbled about for a moment on rubbery legs, then fell to the floor.
"Now, young lady," Findlay said, "you've caused me a hell of a lot of trouble. I'll just take the thing you're carrying in your left shoe. I could tell from the way you were limping there was something."
He jerked off the shoe, looked inside, seemed puzzled, then suddenly grabbed the girl's stockinged foot. She kicked and tried to scream, but the wind had been knocked out of her. Findlay reached casual hands up to the top of her stocking, jerked it loose without bothering to unfasten the garters, pulled the adhesive tape off the bottom of the girl's foot, ran out to the car, and jumped in.
"Well, what do you know?" he exclaimed. "The damn yokel took the keys with him. So there's a paved road on the other side of the mountains, is there? Come on, horse. I guess there's a trail we can find. If we can't, they'll never locate us in all that timber."
Moving swiftly, the fat man ran over to where the horse was standing on three legs, drowsing in the sunlight. Findlay gathered up the reins, thrust one foot in the stirrup, grabbed the saddle, front and rear, and swung himself awkwardly into position. Jane heard a shrill, animal squeal of rage. The sleepy-looking horse, transformed into a bundle of dynamite, heaved himself into the air, ears laid back along his neck. The fat man, grabbing the horn of the saddle, clung with frenzied desperation.
"Well," Kane asked, "are you going to untie me or just stand there gawking?"
She ran to him then, frantically tugging at the knot. The second his hands were freed, Kane went into action. Findlay, half out of the saddle, clung drunkenly to the pitching horse for a moment, then went into the air, turned half over, and came down with a jar that shook the earth. Kane emerged from the cabin holding a rifle.
"All right, Findlay, it's my turn now," Kane said. "Don't make a move for that gun."
The shaken Findlay seemed to have trouble orienting himself. He turned dazedly toward the sound of the voice, clawed for his gun. Kane, aiming the rifle carefully, shot it out of his hand.
"Now, ma'am," Kane said, "if you want to get that paper out of his pocket."
She ran to Findlay, her feet fairly flying over the ground despite the fact that she was wearing only one shoe and the other foot had neither shoe nor stocking. Shortly before noon, Jane Marlowe decided to invade the sacred precincts of Buck Doxey's thoroughly masculine kitchen to prepare lunch. Howard Kane showed his respect for Findlay's resourcefulness by keeping him covered despite the man's bound wrists.
"Buck is going to hate me for this," she said. "Not that he doesn't hate me enough already, and I don't know why."
"Buck's soured on women," Kane explained. "I tried to tip you off. He was engaged to a girl in Cheyenne. No one knows exactly what happened, but they split up. I think she's as miserable as he is, but neither one will make the first move. But for heaven's sake, don't try to rearrange his kitchen according to ideas of feminine efficiency. Just open a can of something and make coffee."
Findlay said,
"I don't suppose there's any use trying to make a deal with you two."
Kane scornfully sighted along the gun by way of answer. Jane, opening drawers in the kitchen, trying to locate the utensils, inadvertently stumbled on Buck Doxey's private heartache, a drawer containing letters and the photograph of a girl. The photograph had been torn into several pieces and then laboriously pasted together and covered with cellophane. The front of the picture was inscribed, "To Buck, with all my heart, Pearl." Jane felt a surge of guilt at even having opened the drawer, but feminine curiosity caused her to hesitate long enough before closing it to notice Pearl's return address in the upper left-hand corner of one of the envelopes addressed to Buck Doxey. It was as they were finishing lunch that they heard the roar of the plane. They went to the door to watch it turn into the teeth of the cold north wind, settle to a landing, then taxi up to the low log buildings. The sheriff and Buck Doxie started running toward the cabins, and it was solace to Jane Marlowe's pride to see the look of almost comic relief on the face of the sheriff as he saw Kane with the rifle and Findlay with bound wrists. Jane heard the last part of Doxie's hurried explanation to Kane.
"Wouldn't trust a woman that far, but her story held together and his didn't. I thought you'd understand what I was doing. I flew in with the sheriff just so I could call the FBI in Los Angeles. What do you know? Findlay is a badly wanted enemy spy. They want him bad as... How did you make out?"
Kane grinned. "I decided to give Findlay a private third degree. He answered my questions with a gun. If it hadn't been for that horse..."
Buck's face broke into a grin. "He fell for that one?"
"Fell for it and off it," Kane said.
"If he hadn't been a fool tenderfoot, he'd have noticed that I led the horse out from the corral instead of riding him over. Old Fox is a rodeo horse, one of the best bucking broncs in Wyoming. Perfectly gentle until he feels it's time to do his stuff, and then he gives everything he has until he hears the 10-second whistle. I sort of figured Findlay might try something before I could sell the sheriff a bill of goods and get back."
It had been sheer impulse which caused Jane Marlowe to leave the train early in the morning. It was also sheer impulse which caused her to violate the law by forging Pearl's name to a telegram as she went through Cheyenne. The telegram was addressed to Buck Doxie, care of the Forest Ranger Station, and read, "Buck, I am so proud of you. Pearl." Having started the message on its way, Jane looked up Pearl and casually told her of the torn picture which had been so laboriously pasted together. Half an hour later, Jane was once more speeding east aboard the sleek streamliner, wondering whether her efforts on behalf of Cupid had earned her the undying enmity of two people, or had perhaps been successful. When she reached Omaha, two telegrams were delivered. One was from Howard Kane, and read simply, "You were so right. It gets terribly lonely at times. Hold a dinner date open for tonight. You need a bodyguard on your mission, and I am flying to Chicago to meet you at train and discuss the Wyoming climate as a permanent place of residence. Love, Howard." The second telegram was the big surprise. It read, "I guess I had it coming. Pearl and I both send love. I guess I just never realized women are like that. Yours humbly, Buck Doxie."